Welcome to All In, a straight shooting, science-based podcast about periods, fertility, and nurturing health outside of unrealistic beauty expectations. We will mostly, but not exclusively, focus on hypothalamic amenorrhea, HA, a component of the female athlete triad and relative energy deficiency in sport.
I'm Dr. Nicola Rinaldi, scientist and lead author of the book No Period, Now What? I specialize in helping people understand how their eating, exercise, and lifestyle habits are keeping them from hormonal health and their best life. My work focuses on regaining periods, improving fertility, and breaking free of the rules of underlying diet culture. You can book an appointment to speak with me at noperiod.info/appointments and go to noperiod.info/support to join my new online community.
My name is Florence Gillet. I am a certified eating psychology coach and the founder of beyondbodyimage.com, as well as the French Instagram account aminoré_fr. I specialize in weight-inclusive mental and body image recovery. My goal is to help people let go of toxic weight and beauty beliefs to finally feel confident in their bodies.
Florence and I also offer a joint coaching package for people wishing to address different aspects of period recovery in a more personal way, accessible from both of our appointment sites.
Every 2 weeks, the All In podcast brings you real recovery stories, expert insights, and new scientific research on HA, hormonal health, and fertility, with an unmissable touch of body respect and women's empowerment.
Just a reminder that this podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and their guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. It's for informational purposes only. And because each person is so unique, please consult your primary health practitioner for any medical questions.
Music by the Andy Shulman Band, available on Spotify. Hello, Nicola. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. Some ups and some downs, you know, some things that are really positive, like I'm buying a new house, which is super exciting. And some things that are challenges, you know, on the work front. We're working together on translating the book into French, which is fantastic, but it's taking up a lot of time. And that means that I'm letting some other things slide. So, you know, book sales are down a bit and consulting is down a bit. And so, you know, I think if there are people who are listening who don't have the book yet, if you would help support by buying it or booking a call with me, that would be amazing. You know, it's hard to do all the marketing stuff on top of working on the translations and everything else that's going on in my life. So, you know, ups and downs. How about you?
Yeah, I'm great. And you know, you translate the book into several languages at the same time. So kudos to you for doing that. Because it's just
well,
a bit.
I'm
of
not
a,
doing the translations. No, other people are doing the translations.
But it's still a lot of prep and coordination and what works in one language and cultural references and how do we adapt it? Because let's be clear, the original book is a bit America focused, mm-hmm. which is totally yes. normal because this is what yep. you know, and this is where most of you know the girls on the forum, most of us, they were also from the US, so it makes total sense. But I know you spend a lot of time actually going through all the differences and what would make sense in one language that wouldn't make sense in the other. So I know it's a big job. And yes, people, if you listen to us, if you like the podcast, come and support us. You know, we really need your support. And the book is not even a huge investment. It's full of information, not just if you're in the middle of HA or if you're in recovery, but also for after. And actually, this is the topic that we're going to talk about today. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do a short episode about understanding the menstrual cycle a little bit better, right? Yeah. And Nicola, I think you're mostly going to drive this conversation. You're the scientist here. I was amazed, like after I recovered, actually, after I recovered the first time, I didn't really pay attention. I went back into birth control after having my mm-hmm. children. I didn't really think, like, what should I do? Should I do different? I actually had a non-hormonal IUD placed, so I knew I didn't want the extra hormones. But it just felt like, okay, just place the IUD, forget about it, and that's me sorted. It's only later, you know, a few years down the line, that I was like, how about just figuring out what's going on? And because I had a non-hormonal IUD, I could actually already figure out if I was ovulating and when, and all of those things. And it's amazing to me how much of what you see in your menstrual cycle is really a window into your health. And how it's unfathomable for me that we don't tell girls about this much earlier in life. Like, I must have been already 38 or 37 when I figured out maybe I should track my cycle, figure out what's going on outside of conceiving, right? I had done a little bit of that when I was conceiving, but it was obviously completely different. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, about like the importance of the menstrual cycle and why it really matters so much for women's health in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the key point that I really want to drive across is that we often, people think of tracking their cycle, quote unquote, as when is my period coming? How long is my period? But the period is not actually the really important part of the cycle. The important part of the cycle is the ovulation. Without ovulation, you don't have a period. That's what happens when you have hypothalamic amenorrhea, is you're not ovulating, and so therefore you're not getting a period or a bleed. And the hormonal changes that happen around the time of ovulation are also the ones that are most important for bone density, for example, or heart health, because right before you ovulate is when your estrogen is at its highest level, that then triggers the luteinizing hormone surge, the LH surge, that causes the follicle to burst and release the egg. And then the cells that were supporting the growth of the egg sort of alter a little bit. They form a structure called the corpus luteum, and that then secretes progesterone and estrogen to help support the uterine lining, because your body would like to be pregnant. So, you know, that's really the goal for your body is pregnancy. And so that also throughout the luteal phase, your progesterone levels are probably something like 20 to 40 times higher than during the follicular phase or, you know, baseline. And your estradiol also stays on the higher side. So that time during the luteal phase is great for bone building and, you know, all of the other, you know, that's when our hormones are highest and sort of protecting our heart and our brain and all of that. But like I said, that really is driven by the ovulation, and your period happens after the corpus luteum degrades. If you're not pregnant, progesterone drops. That's what causes the menstrual bleed, and estrogen drops. And that drop in estrogen is then sensed by your hypothalamus, and that's what starts the next follicular growth process. So I always say that the menstrual cycles are super cool. It's like a perpetual motion machine, basically. Like each hormone follows after the previous hormone, and that's why we have normal, semi-regular cycles. So, and I think that understanding that ovulation is really the key event in the cycle as opposed to the period is something that we really are not taught about as youngsters. It's like all about when is your period coming? Because that's the physical manifestation. But really understanding the importance of the ovulation itself is paramount.
And not just for conception, because that's the thing I meant to say in the beginning, is that for me, most of my life, I had thought that, you know, you don't need to bother figuring out what's going on with your cycle unless you want to have a baby. But it's completely untrue. Like, it's so important. And all the hormones related to fertility, they are also related to all the other hormones in your body. You know, your thyroid, the cholesterol is related to it. Like, it's not just this kind of little box that you have on the side that you turn it on or off whenever you want to have a baby. It's really something you need to care for and to listen to and to look at, because it's just completely part of who you are as a woman. And I think this is really why we wanted to have this episode today, to talk really how to maybe track your cycle a little bit more concretely. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Like, you know, for those of us who have regained menstrual cycles, thanks to your advice, what do we do when we, you know, got to the level where we had maybe a first, a second cycle? How are we able to really track whether that ovulation is happening, everything is normal? What are the common challenges after people regain their periods? Tell us.
We might need to break this down into a few separate questions.
It's too much, Florence. I was thinking about that. When I was asking, I was like, Florence, too much. Make it simple. How to track?
Yeah. So this is in chapter 18 in the book. The chapter itself is called Getting Pregnant, because when I wrote the book, that was sort of the focus of a lot of people. And, you know, now that the book has been out there for a lot longer, there are a lot of people who are using it who are not doing so for purposes of pregnancy. But that's where the cycle tracking information is. As we're working on the translations, one of the things we're doing is we've separated that out so that the chapter is sort of much more focused just on tracking. And I think, you know, I will send that to everybody that has already purchased the book, whose email addresses I have, once it's available. And I think we'll put together a new English edition as well at some point, maybe later this year. Because the other thing that I'm working on is a chapter on contraception, because I think that's another question that a lot of people have is, I have my cycles back, I don't want to get pregnant. Like, what things can I do? Tracking your cycle is actually quite helpful for avoiding pregnancy as well. Because if you know when you're ovulating, typically you're fertile for about the 5 to 6 days prior to ovulation. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. So that can be a time where you avoid having unprotected intercourse if you would not like to be pregnant at the moment. So as we discuss in the book in chapter 18, and there are a lot of resources out there for cycle tracking. There's Taking Charge of Your Fertility is actually a place where I first learned about tracking my cycle when I was trying to get pregnant many, many moons ago.
Let's not mention years. We don't want to know when that was.
Well, my oldest son is now 15, so it was a long time ago. I can't believe it. He's going to be driving soon. Like, oh my gosh, not ready for that. So anyway, there are two main factors or main things that you can easily track to sort of get a sense of where you are in your cycle, and that's cervical mucus and your basal body temperature. If you want to get a little bit more hardcore, you can also check your cervical position. That's typically more something that people who are trying to get pregnant will focus on. How this all works is just fascinating. So let's do it that way. So as your body is preparing to start ovulating, like the beginning of your cycle, things are going to be kind of tamped down. Like, you won't notice, once you've stopped bleeding from your period, you won't notice much in the way of cervical mucus. You'll have a few days where you feel fairly dry. Your temperature, your basal body temperature, will probably be something like, you know, in the range of maybe 96.8 to 97.3 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe 35.8 to 36.3 or so Celsius.
I'm a little bit higher, by the way. Okay. I'm typically higher. I don't know if it's related to Hashimoto's disease potentially, because obviously I take meds for that for the past 10 years. I still see the surge though. So for me, it's just that the range is smaller. I would say my BBT before ovulation would be more around 36.7, 36.8. Mm-hmm. So just as a side note, I'm not that low, and it still shows, you know, when I go through the surge.
So as your follicle starts growing, your estrogen will rise. That increase in estrogen changes the quality of your cervical mucus. So you might, the progression of mucus is sort of fairly dry maybe something that's sticky or pasty to start with. It'll show on your underwear, kind of looking a bit like cottage cheese, you know, pasty, basically, like thick white, yeah, typically. White. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's not fertile mucus. As your estrogen increases, the quality of that mucus changes. So it might go next to what's called creamy. And again, the terms are fairly descriptively accurate. So it looks a little bit more like hand lotion, say. So still white, as opposed, no, not clear, like, what's the word? Not translucent, mm-hmm, opaque. And again, you would notice it on your underwear, perhaps, but not, it'll be a little bit, it'll feel a little smoother. Yeah. I mean, really, hand lotion is a good description of what it looks like. Yep. The next step is watery mucus. And the mucus then becomes more clear, maybe a little bit more prolific. Maybe there's more of it. But it doesn't really show up on your underwear too much. So it might feel like a wet patch on your underwear as opposed to like something that you can actually visualize. And then that leads to the famous egg white cervical mucus. And when you have either watery, maybe, or definitely when you have egg white cervical mucus is when you have a higher chance of pregnancy. This mucus is very friendly for sperm. It's sort of directs the sperm in a certain direction, basically up into your uterus. And
I'm just imagining the egg white cervical mucus with the outfit, like at the airport, you know, the guy, yeah, that's directing, uh-huh, the planes, like, this way, guys, this way.
Yeah. And so it looks like raw egg whites. And it feels like raw egg whites. It's funny. I had someone asked me, like, cooked egg whites? I'm like, no, 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 not cooked egg whites, raw egg whites. So it's very shiny.
If you feel cooked egg whites in your underwear, go see a doctor immediately.
So slippery, shiny, typically clear, but it can be sort of white tinged or yellow tinged. You know, if it's slightly colored, that doesn't mean it's not egg white mucus. So you're more looking for the texture, yes, color a little bit. It tends to be more translucent. If you sort of collect some, then you can stretch it between your fingers quite a long way. You know, if you sort of have some between your index finger and your thumb, you can typically stretch it at least an inch, maybe even more. Mm-hmm. You might notice, particularly after a bowel movement, that it's sort of dripping out of you into the toilet. It can feel kind of strange sometimes. It's like, oh, I must be ovulating.
It does feel kind of strange. I think I really encourage women to just get more familiar with the, mm-hmm, cervical mucus, because it does feel different. Like I don't look specifically, but I tend to think about it when I wipe after going, mm-hmm, to the bathroom, right?
Yes,
and just exactly. Because obviously I track my temperatures as well, and now it's my method of contraception completely, so I have to be pretty, mm-hmm, accurate with it. I do not want to have another baby. And the feel of it when you wipe is completely, yes, different to, yeah, the rest of the days.
It feels slippery.
As
opposed to the other times, it's maybe a little bit, it just feels drier. And,
exactly. Yeah. So I really, yeah, encourage women to just consistently try and feel how it feels down there, what's, yeah, happening, and not see, I mean, nothing shameful about it, nothing disgusting about it. I think this is one of the things also I find personally, the growing up and definitely as a teen, this idea of like, in French, they don't call it, they don't even call it cervical mucus when they tell you what it is. Mm-hmm. I remember being told those were, they call it almost like white discharge. They just call it, mm-hmm, white discharge or white waste. I find it difficult, mm, to really translate it. So they tell you, if you see something white in your underwear, it's totally normal. But it's almost like, we're not talking about it. It's like almost like something, mm-hmm, a bit shameful, mm-hmm, that's coming out of your body. That's weird. And it's, yeah, not weird, and it's not shameful, because this is amazing what your body does every month. Like,
Yes.
It completely transforms in a way that it's either welcoming the sperm or not welcome, mm-hmm. or closing down completely, drying up. Like, you don't have to think about it. Everything happens naturally. Incredible. And I think for all of us who have had HA, knowing that this is happening is like, mm-hmm. to me, it's like a little miracle. Every month, yes. I'm like, even if I don't want to have a baby, I'm like, wow, you know, my body is doing all those amazing things and I don't even have to, I just have to monitor what's happening. It's great. Yep. So yeah. It's important that we have this conversation. Agree. Yeah. Yes. And I hope that all of you who at some point will have definitely a girl, but even a boy, you know, I will speak to my boy about the fact that girls mm-hmm. have stuff in their underwear and it's not dirty and it's not weird and shameful. It's just completely natural and great.
Yes. Yep.
Sorry. Side note.
No worries. And I think that I find the best way to check my cervical mucus is after a bowel movement, because as you're pushing to push out the feces, poop, whatever you want to call it, that also pushes down your cervix, and that pushes the cervical mucus out of your vagina to your vulva. And so if you kind of dab with the toilet paper instead of just wiping, then you can often kind of check out what's on there. And you know, that's a good way to sort of investigate it and learn a little bit more about what your body is doing.
I love that.
Not everybody notices cervical mucus in that way. Some people find that they do have to reach inside to get the cervical mucus. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing shameful. It's, you know, it's a normal bodily function. It's,
I would say,
you
know, it's almost,
it doesn't
like,
hurt to, you know, it doesn't hurt to stick a finger up there and collect some mucus and check it out.
It's not very different than going into your ear to remove the wax in your ear, to be honest. There's nothing, you know, I see people doing that all the time in the middle of a meeting or anything like that.
Okay,
like,
don't go checking for cervical mucus in the middle of a meeting. That's probably not appropriate.
Might be frowned upon. But but I mean, in between us, right, whoever's listening to us, this is going to be such a fun episode. Just like, really, it's not very different than going and get a booger up your nose. Like, just, we have different, you know, places where stuff happens. It's just fine.
Anyway, yes.
Sorry. So once you see the egg white cervical mucus, let's go back.
Yes. So then once you're having this egg white mucus, you are likely fertile. You have a follicle that's growing, your estrogen is increasing, and that's what leads to the increased cervical mucus. You can have follicular waves, which again, we talk about in the book, and that's sort of if a follicle is growing, but maybe doesn't quite have enough support from your hypothalamus and pituitary to continue to grow all the way. So that follicle can kind of start growing and then die back without getting all the way to ovulation. When that happens, it's a good sign that your recovery is going well. It can happen for somebody who's like well into recovery. Sometimes, you know, maybe if you're super stressed in a particular cycle, if you're ill, you know, you can have a follicular wave that doesn't result in ovulation. It's not a bad thing. Like it's normal for our bodies to not ovulate every single cycle. So it's not something to be overly concerned about. If you're working towards recovery, it's a good sign. If you have had multiple periods and you have one follicular wave that doesn't result in ovulation, it doesn't mean that your period's going to go away again. It's like your body will try again, just maybe baby it a little bit more. Little off topic, but so when you do actually ovulate, the day of ovulation is probably when you will notice the most cervical mucus. It'll be, you know, that's when you might see it dripping into the toilet or feel it. And then once you ovulate, it dries up. You know, sometimes people will be like, oh my God, I had all the cervical mucus and it went away. I'm like, it's not a bad thing. It means you probably ovulated.
That's the point. That's how it works.
Yes. Yes. And that's, I mean, again, it's so cool. Like once you ovulate, your body knows that, okay, the sperm, like we don't need the sperm anymore. So there's no need to direct them there. And, you know,
Incredible.
Let's shut this down.
Yeah.
So if you are, if you are trying not to get pregnant, once you've had it, you know, once the ovulation has happened, your cervical mucus has dried up, I would probably wait a day or two just to be on the safe side. But that's when you can start having unprotected intercourse again, if you have been abstaining or using a barrier method or something like that.
And that's the other thing to think about, is the one thing not to forget if you want to have a baby or don't want to have a baby. It's that sperm stays in your system for 5 days, I think, right?
When you have fertile cervical mucus.
Yeah. So basically, what you want to think about is that even if you're leading up to ovulation and you don't yet see complete signs, or you're not entirely sure you're ovulating, just be careful in that period before ovulation specifically, and a little bit after, because sperm can be a bit tricky in the sense that it can stay longer in your body, thanks to the specific type of mucus that you see around ovulation.
Yes.
Because I remember when I conceived my son, I was sure that I had missed the window. Mm-hmm. My husband was traveling, and it was so funny because I was like, okay, come back. You need to come back. Obviously, he could not change his schedule. He was out for work. He came back. We obviously had sex and tried. We were like, okay, well, you know, what's the bad thing that can happen with that? But I was convinced that it would be too late because I had already seen the signs and I was seeing my mucus drying up and all of that. Boom. My son is there. So be mindful of that.
Yeah. I know quite a number of people who have gotten pregnant with sex 4 to 5 days before ovulation for, you know, whatever reason it might be. But certainly once you start noticing that egg white cervical mucus, like if you would like to be pregnant, you know, that is the time to start, you know, to start working on it. If you do not want to be pregnant, barrier method or abstaining.
What happens after that?
Yeah. So your cervical mucus dries up once you ovulate, and then the corpus luteum is formed, and that's secreting, as we discussed, estrogen and progesterone. So that progesterone increases your basal body temperature. So if you're talking Fahrenheit, you might be looking at something like 97.5 to 98. If you're talking Celsius, maybe 36.4 or 5 to 37. So what you're looking for in your temperature, and we'll talk a little bit more about how to actually take your temperature in a minute, but you're really looking for it to sort of, like, it sort of bounces around in a lower range before you ovulate. And then that range shifts after you ovulate. So you don't expect it to be like exactly the same every day. You know, you're basically just looking for a shift in that range. And so you can have a random spike up or down here or there. It doesn't matter. It's like just looking overall at the pattern, you know, lower to higher. And once your temperature increases, that confirms that you have ovulated. Yeah. Because the temperature is increased by the progesterone. That just makes your body warmer.
And so for me, who starts at a higher level in Celsius, I will be around between 36.6 and 36.8 before ovulation. I will actually jump over 37 after ovulation. So I will get between 37 to 37.2. That will be the sign for me that I ovulated. So, you know, you don't have to be specific at the specific level.
Right.
You don't have to say, oh, if I'm over 37, that doesn't count. No, it's like, depends where you start. And it depends, then obviously you can see the jump. And if you chart it, you can really see that jump.
Yes. So charting, there are a number of apps that are available for tracking your menstrual cycles. I use one called Fertility Friend. I like it because it doesn't have a lot of expectations as far as your cycle goes. So you can set it so that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't expect you to ovulate on cycle day 14, because many of us don't. It doesn't expect you to have a certain luteal phase. Like, some of the apps sort of make these assumptions, and then it's like, it says, oh, you're going to be ovulating. It's like, well, I have no cervical mucus. Like, how do you know that? And it's basically, you're just, they've got this little algorithm or this, you know, they think everybody has a normal cycle, which they don't. So I think really, you know, whatever app you use doesn't matter, but just finding one that doesn't have those sort of preset parameters in there, because that can mislead you, because you think, oh, well, it's an app, it knows what it's talking about. It's like, nah, like follow the body as opposed to the other way around.
Can we talk about that myth as well, that you would have a perfect 28 day cycle and then ovulate on day 14? Honestly, it's only again, like quite recently, that I spent a bit more time looking into fertility awareness, mm-hmm. because I just mm-hmm. don't have another type of birth control. So I need to pretty much nail it. That I'm like, where is that 28 day myth coming from? You know? You're right. A lot of those apps use the calendar method, which mm-hmm. is more, it doesn't look at the signs of your body. It's really looking at, okay, day one, day 14, day 28, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
The reality is, most of us don't function like this. We're humans, we're not robots. Mm-hmm. And something I didn't know, but maybe it's to bring us something to discuss later about hormonal birth control, is that the choice that scientists apparently made when they started hormonal birth control for women was to have this kind of 28-day cycle as mm-hmm. a range that would be considered normal. But they could have chosen 30, or they could have chosen 29. Like, it's just, I didn't know that.
Something that I've learned as I've been working on the contraception chapter, and I'm particularly focusing on bone density issues, because I know a lot of people that have had HA have bone density issues. And so, I personally am not I'm not totally anti hormonal birth control. I think that it can absolutely have its place, and it is generally much more effective than the barrier methods or natural family planning. So, you know, depending on your personal risk assessment or whatever, hormonal birth control might be a reasonable option. So in terms of bone density, studies are finding that with the oral contraceptives, the birth control pills, it's actually better not to have that bleed and just to continue taking the pill fairly continuously, because then your body's exposed to a lot more estrogen and progesterone. If you're doing a 90-day cycle, so you only take 7 days off out of 90 days, you're getting 33% more estrogen than if you're taking 7 days off every month. So that's just, you know, that's just another thing to think about.
But I understood that the problem was that at the beginning, women starting to use those hormonal birth control felt so odd that they didn't have a period, couldn't mm-hmm. believe that they were not pregnant if they weren't seeing a monthly bleed.
Yeah.
And so that's how it started, that, you know, scientists had to kind of comply with what the women were just freaking out about not having a cycle. I found this fascinating.
Is that something you learned from the fifth vital sign?
Yes. It was mm-hmm. in the fifth vital sign by Lisa Hendrickson-Jones. Is that her name? Do I say it correctly?
Lisa Hendrickson-Jax.
Jax. Thank you. Yes. Sorry.
Yep.
So I found this fascinating. I was like, mm-hmm. gosh, I didn't know. I really thought that it was the normal, perfect cycle to have this. But there is no normal perfect cycle, except that it's a cycle where you're going to see all the signs following in the right order.
Yeah.
And
I think we have, with so many people using cycle tracking apps these days, it's actually been really fascinating. There's some really nice papers where researchers have taken all of that data and given us a much better idea of what normal is in terms of the length of cycles, the ovulation days, the luteal phase. I mean, even more than the sort of myth about the 28 day cycle, the average is actually more like 29 to 30, is the idea that the luteal phase is always 14 days. I mean, that one is like hardwired into everybody. And it's like, maybe for people that haven't experienced HA, but certainly for people that have experienced HA, it is super common to have a shorter luteal phase than that. Yeah. And so if you have an app that's assuming you ovulate 14 days before your period, then you know, it's going to be wrong. You know, the Ava bracelet assumes that. Now it does. So that's a bracelet that you wear, and it tracks your tip, your skin temperature, your breathing rate, your heart rate. It's fascinating that all of that actually changes with ovulation as well. But that assumes a 14-day luteal phase. It does adjust as you go, and you're, you know, if it's saying like you should be ovulating now, and it's like there are no signs towards it, then it will shift later, which is what happened with me until it, you know, it took a few cycles to sort of learn my parameters. But I just found that really interesting that, you know, all of those things change as well, like your breathing rate and your heart rate, as well as your temperature.
Yeah.
Our bodies are amazing.
Amazing. And talking of trackers, just my little anti-diet note here. For a while I was using Flow, not because my name is Flow, but, but anyway, and you know, before I really dug deeper into all of this. So Flow is definitely also a calendar app. But the one thing that really pissed me off with them is that one day they give you extra advice and stuff about like how to well-being and whatever. And one day there was something about drinking more water, relating it to weight loss, like random crap. And that's when I said, like, you have to pay for those apps. I'm like, I'm walking away from this. I'm telling them with my money, and it's not very expensive, but it's the point.
Yeah.
So like you, Fertility Friend, I find this really cool because I think also it's NGO based. I don't think I think it's a social enterprise or something. So you, whatever you pay is kind of getting reinvested into the app, or is it like not completely profit-based, if I remember correctly. For me, I didn't really like using Fertility Friend. I felt a little bit overwhelmed by like, ooh, there's nothing at all telling me roughly where I would fall. I use another app called Kindara, which is also not calendar-based. So that's, so I think, you know, experiment, try different things. Don't go and order, like, if you have to pay something, don't go like, say, I'm going to pay for a year. Just try a few cycles, see how it goes. You can have those extra bracelets or rings or whatever helps with taking your body basal temperature, or you can just have a normal thermometer next to your bed. Whatever works for you. Just, I don't know if we told this, but for the BBT, you do need to have slept enough to somehow see a good, accurate reading, right?
I mean, I think, again, it's, you're looking for sort of a temperature, like a shift in the temperature range. So, you know, I think the common wisdom is you have to have slept at least 4 hours in a row. But I know people who just generally don't sleep that well at night. And I think you're still able to see a shift. You know, it may be that, like, maybe your temperature is a little bit lower because you didn't sleep as well. But, you know, as long as you're, as long as things are fairly consistent, then, you know, you will likely be able to see that temperature shift. So a little bit more about the actual process of taking your temperature. I like to experiment, and I found that I didn't have to be nearly as sort of, what's the word, strict about some of the quote unquote rules. Like, you will be told you must take it while you're still lying in bed. You know, you must take it at the same time every day. You know, I'm just, I get up at various times depending on what I'm doing, what I've done the night before. And I don't, like, it makes a little bit of a difference. Like, if you sleep in a couple hours later, your body, your basal temperature will likely be a couple, you know, decimal points higher. But overall, I didn't find that it made that much of a difference. And I actually found that if I didn't, my thermometer beeped, and so I didn't want to wake my husband up when I was taking it. So I would get up, walk to the bathroom, and take it while I was sitting on the toilet. And I found there was, like, again, I experimented. I took my temperature in bed one day, and then I took it on the toilet, and hey, it was the same. So you know what? I can do that. So like, just kind of figure out like what works for you. I mean, now I often forget to take my temperature because I'm not trying to get pregnant. It's more just I'm tracking my cycle for interest's sake. So I found the only way I can remember it in the morning is if I put my thermometer on top of my phone and set an alarm on my phone for the time I want to get up, because otherwise it's like, thermometer, what? One thing that can be helpful is holding the thermometer in your mouth for 10 to 15 seconds before you press the button to take your temperature to allow it to equilibrate. You might read places that you need to hold it in your mouth for 10 minutes. That is not scientifically based, because I mean, that, metal is a good conductor. Like, you know,
that I can stay 10 minutes with that thermometer in my mouth waiting. That's just so awful. That is like completely telling me I'm not doing any of that. And that's it. I'm giving up on tracking. Yep. So it's a bit silly, I find, you know, sometimes you're right. It goes too far and it's a bit.
So, I mean, again, it's like, other things to do with recovery. You figure out what works for you and, you know, just go with it. And if it's not exactly the same as what the next person is doing, who cares? Like, as long as you are able to track your own ovulation, that's the important thing, right?
Do you want to say also a little something about cervical position?
I was just going to get to that. Yes. So the cervical position is absolutely fascinating to me. So when you are not fertile, your cervix will be low and hard. So assessing this requires that you reach inside yourself. I find
with
it
clean fingers.
Clean fingers, probably helpful, yes. So I find that if I just lie in bed and put my knees up, that's a good position. So, you know, I use my index finger. When my cervix is low, I can touch it with my index finger without too much trouble. So, you know, you just kind of stick that there. Some people have, you know, your cervix might be a little bit more to one side or the other. So you just kind of feel around. It feels kind of like a nub, a pencil eraser is what some people will say. You know, it's sort of it's just something you can't push your finger past it, you know? And then as you're getting closer to ovulation, your cervix gets higher and softer. And again, it's sort of related to the changes that are happening in your body with the increased estrogen, and also to allow your body to be more fertile. So the cervix is opening up to allow the sperm to come inside. Again, absolutely fascinating. It's just so amazing. Freaking cool. For a high cervix, I find that I have to actually bear down in kind of the same way as if I'm trying to, you know, poop. That's the only way I can reach it. Like, I can't, if I just stick my finger up there, it's like, I can't find it anywhere. It just feels softer. It's squishier. And, you know, so, and then once you ovulate again, that closes back down. Your cervix gets lower and it gets hard again. It's like, now it's shut down. Like, no more sperm, please. I'm done.
Amazing.
So those are sort of the three main ways for tracking your cycle. And like I said, the cervical position is not something that a lot of people feel comfortable doing, or, you know, feel like it's kind of too much. That's fine. You know, you do you. But I do think that it's really fascinating to just see what that feels like and how that change feels in your body.
Absolutely. I think it's so important. It's really, again, like one of the things that the female genitals is something that is really full of shame and nobody wants to talk about it. I'm pretty sure you can name all the parts of the male genitals, but maybe not your own. You know, I see this all the time that women will mention their vaginas, where it's actually their vulvas they're talking about. And again, like, no judgment whatsoever. I was also in this position in the sense that I this is not something we talk about to little girls, but you can look down there, you can touch down there. There's nothing different than another body part. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And it's important that you know what's happening, where things are, where your clitoris is.
Yes.
Where, you know. I mean, you need to know that stuff. It's really important. The more you're in touch with your genitals and your body in general, the more you're actually embodied. And that plays a role as well in your body image, by the way. Because if you're disconnected or you're like, oh, I cannot, no, ah, can't touch it, can't really do anything. Can't look at it. Looks so horrible. Yeah, I mean, I have to say, the first time you put a mirror down there, you're a bit like, wow, this looks like this. It's just a bit odd, you know? But then you're like, yeah, of course. It's and it's wonderful because it does all those things, you know, and it allowed me to have babies. And, you know, how crazy that the head of a baby went through this and now here I am and it looks pretty normal. And, you know, there are different lengths and shapes and colors and great. Like, this is what humanity is all about.
Body diversity, genitalia diversity. It's all
exactly
good.
Exactly.
So I've recently read a book called Sex Plus. I want to give a huge shout out to that. I was reading it because my 15-year-old is starting to be maybe interested in, you know, having a partner. And I really wanted him to understand his own pleasure and his partner's pleasure in a different way from what's often portrayed on the internet. How people
when
talk
is it,
to each other.
When is it even portrayed, right? When is female pleasure even portrayed? And anyway.
So I actually learned things from the book. So, you know, and it's, I mean, it talks not about it, you know, so it has really nice sort of pictures of everything that's going, you know, our genitalia, the clitoris, the, you know, other pleasure centers. It talks about male and female pleasure. It talks about healthy relationships. It talks about abusive relationships.
Consent.
You know, it's consent. Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, that's a place where I feel like our generation, you know, consent, like asking consent wasn't really a thing. And so reading some of that was like, wow, you know, I can say no if something starts to feel uncomfortable. I don't have to stick it out and just grin and bear it. And it's like, that's a huge revelation for me. And, you know, I really think that for all of us to sort of grow and understand, like, we have power here, you know, that's, I mean, it's huge. It really is.
It's huge. I'm actually quite curious to see what our kids are going to make of this. Because, yeah, I also speak about that all the time with my kids. You know, they're still young, so I don't go into details, but they already had questions. They already want to know stuff. And I'm fairly comfortable with that, which is like, I don't know why. I'm not like a sex expert or anything, but I feel quite confident talking to them about it or answering their questions and stuff. And I feel like, wow, that's going to be already a huge change, right?
Yes.
Because I would never have dared bring that up with my parents, you know? So,
and
yeah,
I think
obviously.
It's nice. It's a language that our children are getting used to using. My 13-year-old was telling me about a game that they play in the locker room. And he's like, oh, we make sure we have consent from everybody. And if somebody says, if somebody changes their mind, then they don't have to play anymore. It's like, what? This is amazing. You know?
totally different. That's great. Send me the details and I'll put the book in the show notes. Because that sounds really interesting. I'm probably going to buy that book too.
Yeah.
Can we also just quickly talk about the major issues that you see, you know, coming to you when it comes to regaining cycles and then noticing that cycles are not completely regular or, you know, doing all the things that they're supposed to do? I don't want to see normal because there's no normal. We're all different. But what are the common issues that you see coming to you and that people listening to us could come to you with and get help with?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of times, especially in early recovery cycles, we don't expect them to be 28 days, 29, 30, whatever it is. We don't expect that from the get-go. We sort of, you know, it's very common to have your first period and then for it to take a while for your second one. And that's why I have a blog post that I think gets referred to a lot about wait 3 cycles before you make any changes, because I was seeing a lot of people like get their first period, be like, woohoo, I'm recovered. And like, let's go add exercise and let's start doing intuitive eating. And then the second cycle is nowhere to be found. So I think kind of giving your body a chance to equilibrate. And also those first few cycles is a great time to learn about your own patterns around ovulation and how long your luteal phase is and all of that, so that you know you have that as a baseline going forward. After that third cycle, or, you know, maybe you need to wait for 4 or 5 cycles. Like, everybody's different. Again, you know, tracking your ovulation, knowing how long a normal luteal phase is for you, then allows you to assess as you're making changes post-recovery, you know, if you're adding exercise or if you're changing your food, how is it impacting my cycle? You know, so that's something that, as you said, I work with people on this all the time, just kind of like, how do I add back exercise? Like, what do I want to do? What kinds of exercise do I want to add? How, you know, that kind of thing. So tracking your ovulation is super helpful for that process.
And I'm sure it's also the questions around, like, I feel like I had a period, but it's very light. What's happening? Or like, I bled there and then I bled again very close by. Like, how to decipher what is happening in recovery. I think
this is
really,
if you're
really
tracking
where...
your ovulation, it makes it so much easier to understand like a double period in a month, or, you know, a late period, or whatever it is.
But I think this is where you can be a guide as well, because it's quite difficult to figure out all those things on your own, right? And I know people can book all sorts of sessions with you. It doesn't have to be like an hour and a half long. It can be shorter. It can be really punctual. It's not super expensive. It's really worth getting that support, because I think it can feel really overwhelming when you first start. Your period is back. You're like, woohoo, my period is back. And then you see all those things and you're like, but it doesn't look like a normal expected cycle. And whether or not you try to conceive, but especially if you try to conceive, then you also have the fertility knowledge that you have. I think we've gone through all the different points that we wanted to mention, didn't we? Is there something else you wanted to say, Nicola?
So I did get a question on Instagram about, when can you stop worrying about your cycle? Like, at what point in recovery can you kind of assume that things are normal? And, you know, I mean, again, varies for everybody, but, you know, I think that sort of a year post recovering your cycle, like, each month your body gets more consistent and more sort of confident in the fact that you will be nourishing it well. And, you know, I mean, I think the ongoing nourishment is really the key factor. You know, if you start restricting your food intake, that's often where people run into problems. So, you know, it's about learning your own body signals, and, you know, definitely over time you can start to eat more intuitively, as in, you know, eating when you're hungry, you know, eating an amount that feels good for your body, not feeling like you have to constantly be stuffing yourself. But at the same time, sort of remaining mindful of eating fairly regularly through the day. Like, going back to intermittent fasting, probably not going to be a good thing. You know, but if you're on a background of being consistently well nourished, like, yes, you can have a day where you skip breakfast, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, you can have a day where you do more high intensity exercise. It's like that kind of thing. Your body just kind of deals with it, because you're on that background of being consistently well nourished. And that's really my plug for ongoing recovery, is just making sure that you're giving your body the energy it needs. And, you know, and from your perspective, like, not going back to focusing on what your body looks like, but sort of enjoying it for what it does for you, right? True. And like, not worrying about, like, you know, an extra roll or two, and maybe in places you didn't have them before. Like, that's okay. Like, look at, you know, now you can go train for a marathon if you want to, or, you know, like me, I play ice hockey multiple times a week and I don't have to think about anything. I move my body. I do the kinds of movements that I enjoy. I eat when I feel like it, what I feel like. You know, some days a little bit more, some days a little bit less, some days a lot more, some day, you know, it's like, it's all good. And it's just like getting out of that mindset of focusing on your appearance. And, you know, I think that that's really a huge part of the long-term recovery.
This is where you can work with me.
yep.
shameless plug here. no, I mean, really, if you recover and you feel uneasy about your body and it's really hard for you to let go of the changes, remember your body image is not in your fat cells, it's in your brain cells. So you losing weight or changing the shape of your body, there's a good chance it's not going to make you feel a lot better about how you look. And it's definitely not going to help with disconnecting from too much importance on the appearance. Mm-hmm. But you can work on improving your body image and being more confident in your body exactly where you are.
Yes.
Without having to revert to dieting, over-exercising, counting everything, calculating everything. It's really something you can work on. And again, like you can, sometimes I see people just for one session. It's not the most efficient, I'm going to be honest. It's kind of a work that you have to do over a few sessions. And we dig deeper also into how we build our self-esteem, how we see ourselves. It's part of the journey as well. But if you only have access to one session, come and book one session and we can bring your questions, bring your discomfort, and we'll see what we can do to help you immediately to develop better coping behaviors and how to see yourself in a wider frame than just the way you look. So yeah, I totally agree with you. Okay, time for a ritual question, Nicola. How are you all in right now?
I might need you to go first this week.
Okay. How am I all in right now? I am all in trying to really keep my cup full, even though I am a bit overwhelmed with things. Like right now, March is always a very busy month for me. I don't always know why. I think it's because it's a time also where Dubai is quite busy. You know, there are lots of events and the weather is really good. And so there's lots of things that you're invited to, but then you also have a lot of work because it's kind of, you know, you're bang in the middle of the time of the year where everything is really hustling and bustling. And, you know, right now we've had a bit of a mishap. My son broke his leg. He needs a lot more attention from me. And then my daughter wants more attention as well because she feels like I'm spending too much time with her brother. It can feel really overwhelming to just try and balance everything out. And then that's usually when I revert to my bad habits, which are, I'm just going to put everybody else first and I'm going to forget about myself. And obviously I cannot do that because if my cup is empty, I cannot pour for anybody else. So I'm going to try right now to keep my cup full by setting better boundaries also. So, you know, when my son is at home today from school because he can't go, I'm going to say to him, I do have to do my work and you're going to have to entertain yourself for a couple of hours. And then maybe we can go together and have lunch, you know, not letting him saying like, oh, but he's going to be bored. So I have to do something about it. So I have to be with him. I don't want him to feel like I can't be with him. No, I have my stuff. He has his stuff and I cannot just drop everything because he wants me to, right? So that's what I'm trying to work on, kind of nurturing my own needs in the middle of this storm that I feel like I'm in.
It makes such a difference when you can do that because as you said, I mean, I find that when I'm feeling empty. I snap at my kids a lot more.
Oh my
and
God, yes.
I just like, I can't focus on them as well. And so I think that's great that you're doing that.
So
I am trying really hard to be all in on just kind of being myself and loving myself. So I'm dipping my toes into the dating pool, and it's a little intimidating. But at the same time, I'm just kind of deciding, like, I'm just going to be me. I'm not going to think about, like, if I say this, what are they going to think? What are they going to do? It's like, I'm just going to be me. And if they don't like me for who I am, well, I don't want to be with them. So, you know, I've reached out to a couple of people, and I'm just kind of just being okay with whatever happens. Like, if they say, no, I'm not interested, then that's fine. It's, you know, that's okay. I'm not taking it as something negative about myself. It's like, maybe they're not in the space to be dating, you know, whatever their reason is, they can have their reasons. It's all good. And I can still be confident that I am a good person and worthy of being with and lovable. And, you know, there's lots of good stuff about me. So, yeah.
Yeah. Nothing to change. Nothing to change to fit in or to fit somebody else's requirements.
And I've just done that so much of my life, is like pushed myself down to conform to what other people want. And like you were saying, to fulfill other people's needs. And I'm just kind of done with that.
Yay, I love this. Oh my God. You are so worthy, Nicola. You are such an amazing person. You're kind and you're smart and you're funny. And yes,
oh, stop.
Please bring all of that to the table. Like, we need more of that. So, and you know, whoever doesn't like it can go on his own path and journey. We don't
or
need
her
them.
Own path, whatever. Yeah,
exactly. So, I love that. That's such a cool update. So that's just 1 hour. We're done for the day.
Excellent.
It was really nice to talk about all these topics. I hope it's going to help our listeners. Do reach out to us if you want more information about the support you can get from any of us. And have a lovely night, Nicola, because it's nighttime for you now.
Yes, it is. It's sleep just about midnight. So, yeah.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
All right. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please take a few minutes to reflect on it and think how you have been all in this past week or few weeks. It always strikes me how different each person's all-in journey is. As I often say, there are many paths to HA and many paths out of it. Your journey is unique.
That is so true. And if you need more support on your journey, you should definitely start with No Period Now What, which you can get at noperiod.info/book.
You can also go to noperiod.info/appointments to schedule a time to speak with me on understanding your blood work, fixing issues underlying your missing periods, and for guidance around fertility treatments, pregnancy, and post-recovery changes.
And visit beyondbodyimage.com/work-with-me to connect with me to overcome the fear of weight gain and finally develop healthy coping mechanisms around stress and your relationship with food, exercise, and your body. Remember, we also have joined clients, so you can access both our domains of expertise within a common coaching package of sessions available from both our websites.
Also, join the No Period Now What Recovery Support Group at noperiod.info/support and let us know how all in is going for you. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast and found it helpful, please drop us a review on iTunes to help more people find it.
All in is not just about period recovery, it's about getting your life back. See you in 2 weeks.
You were lost in Babylon till you got lost again. You were lost in Babylon. Now find yourself and then. Take all that you've learned about what love and loss, pleasure and pain, and never get lost again.